Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Plants communicate, and as they do, their aromatic terpenoids interact with their environment to protect them and to get what they need. Since we're part of their environment, these complex chemical scents affect us also. Distinct from herbal tinctures and concoctions, these oils can be transported through our skin and inhaled to rebalance our hormones, increase production of enzymes to support the liver's detoxification as anti-inflammatories, antivirals, antibiotics, even to control gene expression for the treatment and prevention of cancers. With all this balanced pharmacology around, with its gentle organic milieu intact, why would anyone need to resort to standardized, synthesized, and manipulated pharmaceuticals? And why wouldn't we protect their ecology and promotion? Find out in the next hour. First, an editorial by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. Every cell uses the molecule ATP as a source of energy, whether it's a bacteria or a cell in your body. Last week, scientists at Scripps Research Institute identified the way a short chemical dials up ATP production. The chemical is attached to the ribonucleic acid, that is, transfer RNA, created from the gene responsible for producing ATP in a species of common bacteria. The chemical works by binding to ATP molecules. If left unbound, the transfer RNA continues to its appointed rounds in creating energy. But if the chemical binds an ATP molecule, the transfer RNA does nothing and no additional energy is produced. So when ATP is low, that is, when the cell needs energy, lots of transfer RNA molecules are unbound and so go on to produce lots of ATP. On the other hand, when the cell has lots of ATP and so has lots of energy available, most of the RNA is bound and doesn't produce anything. It's a simple mechanism for explaining energy metabolism in cells. Good to know, but the Scripps researchers go on to talk about how this new discovery offers a new way to produce antibiotics. Simply inject a drug that acts like ATP, but of course isn't, so the chemical binds it, shuts down the transfer RNA, and chokes off energy production. The disease-causing bacteria then starves to death. Look what cool stuff we can do with our discovery is a common feature of both scientific journalism and reports on research in the media. Nice to know, but what can you do with it? It's justification of science by the technologies it can produce, and those technologies fall into well-defined paths, mostly having to do with making money. But there's a second problem lurking here. As with old-style antibiotics, drug companies have to make sure this new-style antibiotic doesn't kill beneficial bacteria your health depends on, or the cells that make your organs that your health depends on, too. Of course, those drug company folks are such geniuses, I'm sure there's nothing to worry about. And that's not all. The Scripps researchers hold out the promise of using similar methods in treating disorders of the human energy metabolism, which would include diabetes, obesity, and metabolic syndrome. They propose a drug that shuts down ATP production in your cells, attacking metabolic disorders at the cellular level. I hope you are as alarmed by this as I am. The technology this research promotes is the manipulation of gene expression using drugs. It is cut from the same cloth as genetic engineering, as in genetically modified organism, a topic of increasing concern in political activism. The Institute for Responsible Technology offers a full feast of critical analyses on the health threats and dodgy science behind this technology. The upshot is that intervening in the chemistry of energy metabolism is playing with fire. Yet another mistake is the basic approach that looks to treat immune challenges and disruptions to energy metabolism as being about chemistry, whether dangerous or benign. That approach completely misunderstands the problem and its causes. Instead of attacking chemicals in cells, we should be asking how to work with organs or with entire organisms or the organism's biological and social environment. A recent example is research reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. Scientists demonstrate how childhood adversity affects immunity and the genes responsible for it throughout life. In other words, the cause and the treatment of impaired immunity are about the organism, its environment, and how the two develop together, and not about the manipulation of the underlying chemical mechanisms. That's not to say that understanding the mechanisms of impaired immunity and metabolic disruption are irrelevant, but that understanding is about chemicals and cells, not about you. After all, it's you who gets sick or becomes diabetic, not your cells. The Scripps research illustrates two dangerous ideas. The first is this confusion in both the scientific and popular literature that health and illness are reducible to chemical processes. The second is that science is justified by the technologies that issue from it. These combine in the belief that manipulation of genes, which means manipulation of the chemicals, DNA and RNA, through drugs and genetic engineering, paves the path to well-being. We're not reducible to our chemistry. Those illusions hide the fact that the practice of science and the development of technology are social processes. The current obsession with all things genetic and science, technology, and popular culture is an artifact of a social process, and it's a social process taking us down a dangerous path. A transcript of this editorial is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now we're going to go to today's topic, which is the healing science of plant aromas. And our guest, Dr. Kurt Schnaubelt, earned his PhD in Germany from Technical University of Munich. He's a leader in aromatherapy in the United States since 1983. He's author of Advanced Aromatherapy, a textbook on scientifically based aromatherapy, and also a more current book, The Healing Intelligence of Essential Oils, which was published last year. He is scientific director of the Pacific Institute of Aromatherapy, an educational and research organization which sponsors international conventions on aromatherapy, and its founder and CEO of Original Swiss Aromatics in San Rafael, California. And we're really pleased to have you on the show. Welcome to you, Kurt.
Thanks for having me on. Happy to be here.
It's a pleasure. So I always think it's a good idea to start a conversation like this by distinguishing between true aromatherapy essential oils and the oils that are produced, or the scents that are produced by the fragrance and scent industry, and because they've co-opted the term aromatherapy.
Well, that's certainly true. In our field, when we really deal with healing, the healing qualities of essential oils, we don't even pay a lot of attention to the industrial side of that and the marketing side of that. I mean, the synthetic fragrances that are being also sold off as aromatherapy. The difference is just really astounding. I mean, the essential oils that we work with, they do come from plants, and they carry the expression of the plant, and they carry the molecules that the plant puts together for the various purposes that it wants to achieve with it, whereas, of course, in synthetics, you're dealing with an entirely different substance from the ground up, because you have substances that come from the laboratory with the adjunct impurities and also hazards, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, in fact, the fragrance industry produces fragrances that have been tested by aerosolizing them, and they contain all of these nasty benzene ring, you know, sort of cancer-causing chemicals, and these are scents that persist far beyond what a natural, unadulterated fragrance would do.
That's certainly true for some of the synthetic substances that are synthetic fragrances. I mean, there's a specific kind that's called the so-called nitro musks. I mean, those are some of the more tenacious fragrances that don't really have a counterpart in nature. So you have a fragrance there that is really, as you say, very, very tenacious and comes with a rather alarming chemistry. It's true.
And one of the things that's confusing for consumers is that, as I said, the fragrance industry has co-opted the term aromatherapy. So when you buy something that says aromatherapy, it may in fact not be a natural fragrance. Even if they say it's a natural fragrance, they can sort of get away with that because they have sort of copied the molecular structure.
Well, there is a whole, the differences there, or there's a whole spectrum of fully synthetic and then really natural, and then there is every imaginable intermediate is present there. So, I mean, there is substances or there is fragrances that are made with so-called nature-identical substances, which I don't really want to go into too deeply. I mean, this is a topic that one could spend quite some time on. But for us, I mean, the way we look at it, there really isn't such a thing as nature-identical. Nature-identical, from the industry side, means that you can write a molecule with the same structural formula as the one in nature. However, there are still physico-chemical differences, et cetera, et cetera. So there is that, and then there is, of course, on the very natural side, there is the substances that just simply straightforwardly come out of the plant. So,
right.
Again, there
right.
is the whole spectrum there.
The reason I brought it up is simply to alert people so that they can be more self-protective about what they buy.
If in that particular case, I think the internet is of great help because everybody will. I mean, a lot of the suppliers that are smaller than those that sell into the large retail chains will try and differentiate themselves by offering purity on pure product. So I think some fair information can be gleaned from the internet in that respect.
You mentioned to me that photosynthesis changes the isotopes in a fragrance, and that's one of the differences.
I did say that, yes. Mm. It is true. I mean, there is two different types of photosynthesis, and as photosynthesis takes the carbon dioxide out of the air and synthesizes carbohydrates from the carbon dioxide in the air, and then of course I have to step back for a second here. I have to preface this. I mean, the carbon that occurs in nature, I mean, be it in the ground, in mineral oil, or be it in the CO2 in the atmosphere, carbon is always made up of two different isotopes, of carbon-12 and carbon-13, and then there is even the radioactive carbon-14, which we typically know indirectly through the carbon dating that we probably have heard of. I mean, when we try and figure out how old something is. I mean, there's a method that is using the carbon-14 decay. But anyways, what is really prominent in every substance is about 99% of carbon-12 and about 1% of carbon-13. And so then in the very fine analysis, it turns out that when photosynthesis happens, that photosynthesis doesn't exactly take as much carbon-12 and carbon-13 from the CO2 as it finds it, but it uses one more than the other. And with this, we can even go back and in certain instances even find out which plant made a certain carbohydrate, because the ratio of those two isotopes could be specific for a plant. So this is, for instance, one of the differences. I mean, it's just a manifest physical difference between the natural substance and a synthetic substance, because the synthetic substance, if it's originating from mineral oil, I mean from petrochemicals, it will reflect the ratio of C12 and C13 that comes with the petrochemicals, and it's not the one that comes with the plant. So there is more differences like this. I mean, we could get very specific there.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone today with Dr. Kurt Schnaubelt. His last name is Schnaubelt. He is a chemist, and he is the author, and he is an educator. He's an author and an educator. His most recent book that we're discussing is The Healing Intelligence of Essential Oils, The Science of Advanced Aromatherapy. One of the things I'd like to just get out of the way before we dig into a little more about the science of these substances and how their bioactive effects work, is that when people are using plant substances, there are concerns about how the plants are raised, if they're wildcrafted to make sure that it's sustainable, that the environmental concerns are tended to. So can you talk a bit about how sustainable, how they're raised, how they're gathered, and things like that?
In our field of the what we tend to call the MAPs, the medicinal aromatic plants, that this is the NGO jargon for the substances that we deal with. Generally, it is strived for to have plants cultivated. I mean, to bring plants into cultivation so that we don't have that much over-harvesting in the wild, wildcrafting, etc. So for many of the aromatic plants that are classic in aromatherapy and are classic in the world of fragrance, they come either from the West, I mean, or they come from global, from they're globally dispersed, or they come oftentimes, like patchouli tends to come from Indonesia and from the East. So what we then see very often is that in these countries that have lower wage levels and developing nations, there is cultivation of these medicinal aromatic plants because they can then be sold off to the developed nations that look for these things. And for us, it's really more relevant whether or not the value addition step, namely the distillation, the creation of value in the essential oil, is happening in the developing nation, so that particular income and revenue occurs there. If you think about it, if people globally do want to have the benefits of the secondary metabolites that are in an essential oil, it is an ecologically sound suggestion to ship across the planet, you know, 1-2 pounds of essential oil as opposed to tons of raw material. Mm. So, I mean, that shipping aspect is actually rather reasonable, I think. And some plants have been over-harvested, but I think it's not our main concern.
So I would think one of the main concerns would be, though, that these plants are raised organically.
Very often, this has actually gone quite far. I mean, the certification process for medicinal aromatic plants is nowadays pretty extensive. And then sometimes they are raised organically by default. Simply, I mean, if you're imagining, if I can go back to the patchouli example, I mean, patchouli coming from Aceh that was hit by the tsunami, there isn't really that much chemistry there. So they're being raised, you know, I'd like to think biodynamically by default, for simply the absence, the lack of chemicals that could be used there. So generally, within the world of medicinal aromatic plants, there is rather good awareness and also rather good compliance. So the plant material is usually pretty clean.
And then the distillation process. I know that in nutritional oils, there are some companies that are using hexane as an extraction solvent. I hope, again, that these oils are not, they don't use solvents in the extraction, or?
This is, there we see the tradition of fragrance. I mean, there are, of course, we don't call those essential oils. There are absolutes that are originally extracted with a solvent. One would do this with petals that contain very fragile chemicals, I mean, where the fragrance would be actually destroyed by the distillation process that involves, of course, the boiling of the plant material for hours and oftentimes for hours on end. So if you have jasmine petals and you would boil them, I mean, the fragrance would be destroyed. So you extract with hexane. You, in fact, do extract with solvent. But then we in aromatherapy are pretty aware of this, and generally then those substances are really used for fragrance, and mostly for fragrance, and then maybe the psychology that you attach with it, but they would not be used in the typical also for ingestion or also for topical use aromatherapy synergies.
Got it. That would seem important. So you know, as I said in the beginning of the show, these plants produce they're volatile organic compounds that get released into the air for action. They cause actions and various things. One thing that's interesting about using essential oils as opposed to plant extracts is the method of use, that you're using topical inhalation and whatnot. Are there other distinctions between using essential oils for healing or prevention of a pathology as opposed to using extracts of plant material ingested?
Generally, the main difference is, or there is two main differences that I'd like to, you know, articulate here. One is that in the essential oils, because they are volatile, I mean, because the way they are being made and received through the distillation process, the molecular size of the molecules in an essential oil is very small. Typically, the molecules have structures with 10 carbon atoms and maybe an oxygen attached or two, or 15 carbons. That's what's making up the bulk of essential oils. I mean, so you have terpenoids with 10 carbons and sesquiterpenoids with 15, and you have phenylpropanoids with 9. I always like to make the comparison. If the listener looks around in the room that you're in or the car that you're driving in, there is really no molecule that is smaller than the essential oil, with the exception of the air, the oxygen and the nitrogen in the air you're breathing. I mean, water is a smaller molecule, but water is associated. I mean, there is large chains of water that associate. So if you look at the essential oil molecule having a molecular weight of 150, 160, those are some of the smallest molecules that we deal with in daily life. So that's one of the reasons why the essential oils, when they're used topically, will penetrate. I mean, they're also lipophilic. I mean, they like the fatty tissue that we have. So that's why they have such an easy time penetrating our tissue, because the molecules are so very small, generally a lot smaller than what you get in tinctures. Second point is that you have all the secondary metabolites in the essential oils only. There is no filler. There is no alcohol as in the tincture. So in the tincture, you have many different things, but they all arrive in the solution in alcohol. So you have 1% of maybe, I don't know what, you know, mother tinctures, I mean, you have more or less active ingredient in there, but you have the mixture only as a part of the whole liquid, whereas in the essential oil, you just have secondary metabolites from plants, and that's it.
So does this make the effect, shall we say, more subtle or safer because you're maintaining more of the organic milieu?
I think it makes it depends on what oil you're using and which way. It can range from very subtle and very sustained at the same time to screeching. I mean, if you really want to
tea tree
do that,
oil.
Screeching
yeah.
irritation. I mean, you can do all of the above.
Yeah, got it. Okay, so you keep mentioning, something else that caught my eye in the book was your discussion comparing philosophically physicalism versus vitalism. So having everything just be the material world versus the sense that vitality, or not just what we see physically, but the vitality or energy of things is also important. And now you've raised a new phrase, organicism. So do you want to explain? Is that...
Gladly.
Yeah.
Well, this is me personally thinking. I mean, this is my thought process. Of course, being in the Bay Area 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and in the healing plant environment, one would sooner or later also meet Dr. Paul Lee. I mean, who was, I guess, one of the great storytellers about vitalism and physicalism, and so you get drawn into this topic. I don't think I have to explain physicalism and vitalism here, but today the terminology is, it has changed a little bit. It became, I'm almost not comfortable admitting it, but it became more scientifically sound. Because if you read biology today, I mean standard mainstream biology holds that in the system that they call systems biology, there is such a thing as organicism, and within organicism they hold that as you go from lower levels of biological organization of an organism to the higher levels, you have so-called emerging properties. So when you have a cell, you can know everything about the cell, but when all the cells come together, it is not possible from the most intimate knowledge of the cell itself to know that as you put billions of these cells together, the resulting organ is going to be a kidney and it's going to filter water. Or if you know all the molecules, my favorite example, you know all the molecules in the cat, you're not going to be able to predict from those molecules whether this cat's going to be territorial or not. So biology today works off of the premise that in a complete organism, at the very high or as the levels of organization become more complex, you have properties and emerging that are emerging at that level of the biological organism, whatever the level of organization is, and they cannot be predicted from the chemistry, or from the chemistry alone. So this, of course, is the one step that has been missing in looking at healing plants and medicinal aromatic plants, where we always use a pharmacology-only kind of viewpoint, where we look at the chemicals and then we think we have to know everything, but then we use the plant in real life and we notice that there is qualities and properties that the pharmacology wasn't able to tell us about.
Right, there's an ineffable quality.
Right.
Yeah. So here we have these volatile organic compounds that communicate with our cells, and I think this might lead you into a discussion of what you mean by secondary metabolites.
Well, secondary metabolites in biology are all these substances that the plants make, which they do not need for one can call the day-to-day economy. So the primary metabolism is comprised of all the substances that deal with absorption of energy, storage of energy, reproduction, etc. So what the plant, the substances that are needed for the organism for its day-to-day survival. Now, whether or not the lavender has a certain component in its fragrance or not does not really impact the survival of the lavender plant right now. It may impact it in the long run. So the secondary metabolites are there for the plant to improve the odds of survival and procreation. So they aid the process of survival and procreation in the long run. So they attract pollinators, they defend against herbivores, they talk to other plants and synchronize whatever the plants are doing. So there is many different tasks that these secondary plant metabolites actually shoulder and perform in the service of the longer-range survival of the plant.
So they're communicating with these things and with us, ultimately.
It is the communication system of the plant, yeah. I mean, and especially those substances that the plant can release in the air, where we're coming back to the smaller molecules. I mean, so the plant makes these small molecules, so they remain volatile and can talk for the plant over a distance, as we, you know, the plants are stationary. They don't walk around.
Not yet. They may do it with the increase of, you know, I have to think that, well, that maybe the things that we see influencing our environment, the heating and the pollution, is probably affecting these plants too, and it may. I wonder if it will change their secondary metabolites.
The secondary metabolites of a plant, in my experience and the way I have been able to explore this, are always an immediate reaction of the plant to its environment and the condition that the plant has to contend with to ensure its survival.
Right.
That's actually where a lot of the healing energy or the healing qualities, I'd like to say, of these mixture of essential oils comes from, because they really carry and contain the intention of the plant to survive. So in order to do that, the plant needs to achieve certain things and physiologically, and that's why we're using these essential oils, because they achieve the same physiological feat for us as they do for the plant. So it's the smart human being that can actually identify what the oils are doing, and then you use it for the same purpose.
We're going to take just a very brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone today with PhD Dr. Kurt Schnaubelt, who is the author of several books. He's an educator. His book that we're discussing today is The Healing Intelligence of Essential Oils, The Science of Advanced Aromatherapy. We're going to put some music on and give you a brief break, and we'll be right back with this conversation if you stay with us. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our over 500 archive shows. Check out the changes to our library card feature, find out about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. If you want to reach us, please do email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Again, we're talking to Dr. Kurt Schnaubelt, who is an educator in aromatherapy, has a school and whatnot. Do you want to give out a website for people to go to?
Certainly, and that would be www.pacificinstituteofaromatherapy.com, all one word, all together.
So why don't you do that one more time?
pacificinstituteofaromatherapy.com.
Okay. So it might make sense to explore some more specific areas where these plant oils, these aromatherapy oils, can be used and are really shining in terms of how they're used and really have an effect. So, you know, one of the things that's really impressive, for instance, is to read about limonene, how it changes and influences the amount of enzymes that are produced during phase two detoxification in the liver. So I'd like you to maybe just talk about some of the areas that you explore in the book. You also have very specific areas that you talk about in the book in terms of healing using these oils, and I'd like you to just go ahead and maybe talk about the liver support, about detoxification, about cancer, about mood, balancing hormones, some of that.
Certainly. One of the things that is especially in the healing intelligence of essential oils that is new in the book, and which I'd like to think is also new in the world of aromatherapy, is really that it presents the possible applications of essential oils for cancer patients. Now, and not for cancer patients in the sense that you treat the cancer with the essential oils, but that in fact you substantially and dramatically reduce the side effects of conventional treatments. Now, there has been really extended and substantive study in France on exactly that topic, on treating cancer patients that receive chemotherapy or that receive radiation therapy with essential oils, I mean, concurrent with the therapies, to reduce the side effects. So that leads to the patient tolerating the conventional treatment better, and ultimately it was able to show patients receiving essential oil care concurrently with their conventional treatment had much improved survival rates. Now, a strong part of that is, of course, due to what you mentioned, the ability of the essential oils to influence phase one and phase two liver detoxification enzymes. So with quite some essential oils, we find what we find with lemon essential oil, that actually they slow down just a tad the phase one, the so-called cytochromes, which sometimes produce actually toxic intermediates if there is too much cytochrome activity going on all at the same time. But then in a case like lemon oil, the actual phase two enzymes are induced very forcefully. So if there is any toxic substances in the liver or in the gut where the phase two enzymes are being active, then they're being coupled to the glutathione, for instance, and eliminated through the kidney. So there is no lingering carcinogens if there is sufficient phase two enzyme activity. So quite some essential oils are able to do that. And there is even some where I think the mechanism hasn't been really elucidated, but there is essential oils in that context of helping the cancer patients with the side effects of the conventional treatments, where it has been shown that the essential oils, in fact, reduce pathologically elevated liver enzyme levels. So, I mean, when you go to the doctor and have your GOT and the various enzyme levels done, one of the things that shows pathology is when they're elevated, when too much of those enzymes actually penetrates from the liver cell, the hepatocytes, into the bloodstream, and so they're being found in the bloodstream. Now, what some of these essential oils apparently are able to do is to re-establish the integrity of the membrane of the liver cells and bring down the pathologically elevated liver enzyme levels and restart and improve the functioning of the detoxification function of the liver. So we find that quite spectacular, actually.
I want to go into that to further in a moment and discuss treatments for things like Hep C and cirrhosis and things like that. But one thing that really caught my attention, and I realized that you can't make sort of claims, medical claims, about the oils. So you may be cautious in what you say, but you have a discussion about how you can use these aromatics to alter gene expression. And many very cutting-edge cancer doctors who are looking at alternative treatments that are non-toxic for cancer are doing just that. They're looking at both nutritional supplements and possibly plant supplements that do change the way the gene expression works, because it isn't, you know, you don't get cancer because you're necessarily because you're genetically predisposed. It may be that you may have a genetic propensity, but then the environment is the thing that actually causes this to happen. So being able to influence which genes turn on and which turn off is a way of preventing cancer.
It certainly is. And as you say, I mean, the people, or at least we in aromatherapy, we have to be careful with what we say. But if you look at the secondary metabolites and their low molecular weight and their ability to get into the cell, and also then you integrate this with the knowledge from systems biology that the plants have interacted with mammals for quite some time, so you're not surprised that on the nucleus, and this is just an example without a therapeutic application that I could give you, but on the cell nucleus, we have a receptor for farnesene. Farnesene is a sesquiterpene hydrocarbon that's prevalent in chamomile or in rose. So that receptor is there not because Pfizer put it there, but it's there because we evolved to the point where we have this. I mean, even though the researchers don't know what it is actually what the effect of it is, or what the mechanism is that ensues when the farnesene hits the receptor, there is one for farnesene. But, you know, that being as it is, one of the things that has become clear is, if I can step back to the point of low molecular weight and the essential oil components going into the tissue and going into the cell, one of the things that is always true is that they interact with functional proteins. The proteins, like enzymes, like the substances that regulate the gene expression, those are functional proteins, and they have lipophilic areas. Proteins are not just polar arrays of amino acid after amino acid. There are certain areas in proteins that are a little bit more lipophilic than others, and it's very common for the essential oil molecules to interact with the lipophilic, I mean, the like seeks like. So the lipophilic essential oils then insert themselves into lipophilic areas of these functional proteins that regulate gene expression and thereby change their functionality. Even if I don't have a specific case now in front of me that I could recite, it is totally logical for the biochemist that looks at this that essential oils would interact with the proteins that regulate gene expression. So we're just seeing some of the things recently. I mean, actually, one example I can that just comes to my mind, re-enters my mind, is this is a while ago. An insurance company in Sweden was investigating loggers, because they were out there like 12 hours a day or 8 hours a day and logging, and they were exposed to all these terpenoids from the pine trees. And
that's
so
right.
The insurance company thought that maybe, you know, being exposed to all these pine oil substances would be a risk. And so I'm sure they were looking for charging higher premiums for these loggers. However, they found out when mm-hmm. they really did the analysis that what the substances from the pine oils did is they supported the expression of those genes in the lagers that would support higher metabolic turnover and detoxification. So they found out that the actual opposite was true, that it wasn't really detrimental to be exposed to these substances, but beneficial, by improving the expression of the genes that improved metabolic turnover and detoxification.
Well, it speaks to some shows we did recently about trees and the importance of trees in maintaining climate, producing climate and maintaining climate and cooling the planet. And it's one of the big issues right now is that, I mean, it's now that I'm aware of this, it's like I'm overwhelmed all the time because trees are being cut all the time and we've lost 90%, 97%, I think, of all our old growth forests, and they're still cutting trees. So we're in a real crisis here. But another reason for not doing this is not related to climate, but because of these aromatic terpenoids that trees release. And the gentlemen that we interviewed, Jim Robbins and David Millark, have pointed to research that show that some of these trees, like black walnut trees, produce certain materials that seem to be prophylactic in the prevention of breast cancer. There are all kinds of other substances, as you said, with pine. There's also just the soporific or relaxing effects of our giant redwoods here in Northern California. But it's clear that along with using oil, I mean, here we have this modern society, people living in cities, so they're buying essential oils and they're using them, but living among trees and plants and eating them and having them near you is also medicinal.
Of course it is, and this would not only be true for the trees. I mean, this is actually, I mean, the in what is maybe the a coming trend in aromatherapy is, I mean, to understand that these secondary metabolites from trees or aromatic plants, I mean, including also spices, of course,
yes,
is you know, you look at them as dietary agents. I mean, they are interacting not just with the functional proteins that would be the ones that regulate gene expression. But I mean, it's very, I mean, the rage right now is to check aromatic substances whether or not they inhibit nuclear factor kappa B. I mean, what their influence on the cell cycle is, whether or not they support apoptosis or other
right.
molecular receptors or entities that will be stimulated, upregulated, or downregulated, as the jargon goes, from activator protein to all sorts of different types of tumor necrosis factors.
Right.
So there is an ever-growing body of literature on this, how we can use just regular spices to be utterly preventive.
Yeah, to prevent cells from dividing and proliferating and also the necrotic stuff that happens with some of these viral
exactly.
conditions. Let's go back to the liver for a second, because you said that you can affect enzymes in the liver. So one obvious use, and you cover it in your book, is hepatitis C or any other. I mean, hepatitis C is a viral, so you've got not only the issue of protecting the liver with the, you know, the enzyme stuff, but also you've got a virus, which also essential oils are very good for.
There has been not an enormous body of science, but quite some in France, on the actual efficacy of essential oils in lowering the viral load for Hep B and Hep C patients. So essential oils are capable of doing that. I mean, essentially, it has been shown repeatedly that essential oils have antiviral properties. But I mean, you know, from going at a petri dish with a cell culture that is inoculated with virus and demonstrating efficacy against the virus there, to actually showing that essential oils can reduce the viral load in hepatitis C patients is quite a step. So, but that has been demonstrated.
Wow, that's wonderful.
I mean, I don't know if I should add some essential oils. I mean,
please do.
So there is essential oils like Ravintsara, for instance, Cinnamomum camphora from.
Wait, what was the first one? Ravintsara.
It's Ravintsara. That's the common name in Madagascar. Ravintsara.
Oh.
And the botanical is Cinnamomum camphora. It's actually, it's a chemotype of Cinnamomum camphora. It's of the camphor tree, basically. It's a, but it's the leaf that is distilled. And it's quite common in aromatherapy, so that would be effective. Then there is neroli oil, Melaleuca quinquenervia.
Say the first word again. Is it neroli?
No, it's not neroli. It's neroli. It's N-I-A-O-U-L-I, neroli. From New Caledonia, from Indonesia, from Java, Madagascar. A very inexpensive essential oil, actually, also being used to reduce the viral load in Hep C patients. And then there is an essential oil, which is really an aromatherapy specialty. There is a specific chemotype, a chemotype of thyme, called thyme thionyl, which is also utterly efficient in doing that. And then in that study also, the oils that were used to actually improve the integrity of the liver of the membrane of the liver cells, there were like oils like Greenland moss, which is Ledum Greenlandicum. It's actually from Quebec, and carrot seed, and bay laurel.
And I would guess that some of these are also good for people whose livers may be failing for, you know, they're cirrhotic or they're fatty or something like that? Or not so much because it's not a viral cause?
People have tried it, and when you sometimes it's difficult for us to follow up, but people come back and want more of the oil, so we gather it's working, and sometimes patients that have situations like this, I mean, they often call us from way afar, and then they have the oil shipped all around the globe, and then they come back. So we must assume there is some validity to it.
It, you know, additionally, you're discussing Chinese medicine and essential oils, which I've never made that connection before. But I guess Chinese medicine does use, or are you saying if you're looking at Chinese medicine healing model in terms of how the oils work?
I think it's a new development that some of the really outstanding proponents of Chinese medicine, especially in the United States here, have picked up on aromatherapy. And I think it's rooted in the tradition. I think when it just hasn't been quote-unquote fashionable in Chinese medicine to use essential oils, but when you go back to their old textbooks, there is actually quite a literature on using essential oils or the rarefied fragrances from aromatic plants. So there is a history there, and it's been the privilege of some of I think the mentors that I have. I mean that they combined the essential oils with the Chinese medical perspective. And one of the sentences I picked up, a one-liner that always fascinated me and that I like to quote, is the essential oils, I mean, comparing essential oils to the needles of acupuncture is, I mean, you can put the essential oils on the Mu points on the acupuncture points. And the one-liner that fascinated me was, why do I need the needle when I have an essential oil that already has a character?
And then you have a self-treatment.
Right.
Yeah. So I want to go on to how to deliver these aromatics. But before we go there, we should probably talk about mood, because I think, you know, there's the company that you have that sells essential oil, Swiss Aromatics, has a number of combinations for different things like deep sleep or various other things, or even healing skin ailments and stuff. But mood is a big issue for people. And, you know, most people think, oh, well, lavender oil or this or that. But maybe you should say a word or two about mood and some oils at work.
Gladly. And the way that essential oils typically have oftentimes stronger than expected influence on mood is via the autonomic nervous system. Again, that's what the essential oils do. They interact with receptor sites. They interact with functional proteins. And so also they interact with the workings of the autonomic nervous system. So some people, of course, some of us are parasympathetic, others are sympathetic, and so the conditions and moods and the state of mind or state of emotion or our physical being at that moment and also our emotional being really is strongly influenced by the status of the autonomic nervous system. So if an individual finds the essential oil that rebalances, re-equilibrates the autonomic nervous system in a way that suits me, suits you, the effects that are to be had are oftentimes spectacular.
Well, they would be, especially now when people are being bombarded with increasing amounts of non-ionizing radiation, which tends to cause a ramp up of the sympathetic nervous system. So calming and increasing capacity for sleep, you know, encouraging the parasympathetic, would be really important at times like this.
It certainly would be, and there is, it's not rocket science, I mean, in aromatherapy to find essential oils that support sleep. I mean, one of the things that really does is these, I mean, Melissa is essential oil is not an inexpensive essential oil, but then again, like one drop already goes a long way, and for instance, the Melissa really makes the sleep a lot sounder, especially for those sympatotonic types.
You also discuss the skin in the book, and you also discuss autoimmunity. Autoimmunity is interesting because you've got an immune system in a hypervigilant state that's been triggered by potentially some kind of self-allergy. So maybe say something about autoimmunity and then a little about skin.
For the suggestions to how to employ essential oils for autoimmune conditions, I rely more or less entirely on the classical Chinese medical perspective. The Chinese medical perspective sees the autoimmune condition, as you say, as a case of a hypervigilant immune system, because at some point there was, to use the jargon there, there was a pathogenic factor that whatever it is entered the body, and the immune system was not able to properly remove it entirely, so there's a lingering leftover of the pathogenic factor. And then as the immune system tries by inflammation and by this and by that to eliminate, it fails. And then so it goes back and we are weak and it goes back into hiding. And when we feel strong, then the immune system makes yet another attempt. It's what we call another episode another attempt to remove the pathogenic factors. So one of the things that we can do in aromatherapy for that is, first of all, to try and get the person, the patient, to not use cortisone so much or even eliminate the use of cortisone.
Yes.
And thereby reducing the tendency for auto-intoxication, because, of course, the cortisone only allows us to, you know, pile up more, rack up more toxins that the body then doesn't eliminate because we take the cortisone.
Yeah, it causes a shock reaction, and it also suppresses your native anti-inflammatory.
Yeah.
So a brief word about the skin, if you can.
Gladly. The skin, for skin, there is one oil that has become really famous and probably already kind of went beyond the boundaries of aromatherapy. It's the essential oil of Everlast. Helichrysum metallicum, which is not as exotic as it may sound in the Pacific Northwest here. I mean, it grows here we see it in Marin in the parking lot. It comes out of the cracks in the parking lot. In the Northwest, it's called curry plant, Helichrysum metallicum. So it's not at all that exotic. But the essential oil of that particular plant is just completely unrivaled as a wound healer and also as an agent to treat and heal scars, young scars, old scars, and one doesn't have to use the essential oil per se. I mean, this particular essential oil works exceedingly well also in high dilution in any kind of base oil that one would like, in sesame or olive, whatever, you know, one would want to choose. Diluting it down to all the way down to 1% and then using it on scars, the scars will go away sooner or later, but they will.
So right now you're talking about a topical through the skin application, and sometimes these oils are aerosolized, or you know, you inhale the vapor or you put them in a diffuser, and in some cases you can ingest oils. So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. If you could, maybe 3 minutes, if you could maybe discuss that a bit.
One of the favorite ways to use the essential oils for the respiratory system that I have, or I like to recommend, is is very simple, and that is to take a two-inch by two-inch piece of paper towel and create your favorite respiratory essential oil synergy and put two drops in that piece of paper towel, roll it up into a nice spindle roll, stick it in the nostril, ideally in the evening when nobody sees you before you go to bed, and inhale through through this contraption that you just made yourself with the paper towel. It is most efficient in preventing colds and upper respiratory situations. When we feel it's coming on, and we do this in the evening for 10 minutes, the effects are oftentimes absolutely unbelievable. I mean, so there's really strong efficacy there. It's not, or just dropping it on the pillow also and sleeping on it. So there is, it's not even necessary to get complex machinery for that. Now, that's the one thing. On the ingestion of the essential oil, it has been maligned, I think, not really for a good reason. The great cautionary things that have been written about it is mostly because they refer to essential oils that are not really authentic, that have maybe synthetics in them. And then, of course, you do not want to take those oils internally. However, if you have an organic, authentic lemon oil, putting a drop of lemon oil in a glass of water, or maybe two drops, or maybe even three drops, and drinking that will have the most beneficial detoxification effect, and there really is no toxicity associated to the lemon oil at all.
That's remarkable. I know that you can do this with some of the other oils, too, and you mentioned even cinnamon oil, which is very, very strong stuff. You don't want to put that directly on your skin without diluting it, but apparently in some instances a dose of cinnamon oil has a remarkable effect in an acute situation.
Cinnamon oil is a little bit difficult, yes, because for some individuals it actually causes rather dramatic dermatitis episodes if it goes on the skin. However, apparently even by those, it's tolerated just fine internally. So the cinnamon oil should not go on the skin, but it is tolerated internally. And yes, it is effective against 98% of all pathogenic bacteria. So for those that travel in the jungles of Java or in wherever you go in exotic tropical locales, bringing a drop of or a bottle of cinnamon oil is the insurance against unforeseen intestinal infections, etc. It's true.
Yeah, and actually eating the spice is very good for diabetics as well.
That is true.
Yeah. So why don't you give out your website again so people can go and see when your classes are and what your books are and all the, and find out about ordering things?
The website is PacificInstituteOfAromatherapy.com. There also is a website if people want to go directly to maybe look at some of the essential oils. I mean, that would be OriginalSwissAromatics.com.
Okay.
From there, all the other information is available.
Thank you so much for taking the time today to discuss this. What a wonderful, you know, hour of educational material about aromatherapy. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, Kurt. Kurt Schnabel, S-C-H-N-A-U-B-E-L-T, Ph.D., author of The Healing Intelligence of Essential Oils, The Science of Advanced Aromatherapy. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our archive shows. You can find our library card. You can get information about who you heard on the show and contact information, our practice, a free stream of the show if you'd like, our book, and lots more. yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you'd like to reach us, please do it by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Jeff Fawcett and Lena Berman. And remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom